So I want to tell you about some work that actually was mostly done here together with Paco Guinea, and we also got some help from a postdoc of mine, Eros Mariani. The title is Synthetic or Fictitious or Effective Electric Fields in Graphene and Carbon Nanotubes. So the starting point is that if you have long wavelength strain of the graphene lattice, then I'm sure many of you know that in the Dirac equation for the electronic excitations of graphene, you'll start to have these effective or synthetic gauge fields. So the Dirac Hamiltonian then looks like that. So if you set, let's take the E's out here. So if you set E and A and phi to zero, then that's the usual Hamiltonian for graphene in the vicinity of the Dirac point, just restricted to a single valley, so sigma are the Pauli matrices. And if you now have strain of the lattice, then you induce both a vector potential and a scalar potential into the Dirac equation. And the vector potential, if you write it in terms of the strain tensor, has some prefactor, and then it's essentially given by the following components. Of the strain tensor Uij, so Uij is 1/2 di Uj plus dj Ui, where Ui are the displacements of the atoms of the lattice. And this form, in fact, is entirely constrained by symmetry, because what you want to do is to make a vector out of a tensor. And there's only one way of doing that that preserves the symmetry of the graphene lattice. And so this is what you get. The scalar potential again by symmetry is just proportional to the trace of the strain tensor with some prefactor GD. And so this is something that is well known and, in fact, has been talked about a lot. And in particular, what people have focused on is that if you have the static situation, then the curl of the fictitious vector potential gives you a magnetic field. And that magnetic field then suppresses weak localization. That's a story that is quite familiar. And it's well known. And then people have also looked at various other consequences of this effective magnetic field in the past. But now, this is what you have if you have static strain. Now, if you have time-dependent strain, then this vector potential becomes time-dependent, and then you not only have a vector potential, but you also have a synthetic electric field associated with this vector potential. And the simple question that I want to ask in this talk today is whether this synthetic electric field associated with the vector potential is actually observable, has any physical consequences in graphene or not. So the obvious context to think of is phonons, where you do have this time-dependent strain. And again, so the question is this synthetic E observable? And the answer is yes, and that's what the rest of the talk is about. So let me back up for a second and first of all remind you of the origin of these vector and scalar potentials, and then we get to the other thing. So you can think of the origin of A and phi in two possible ways. First of all, you can think about it microscopically. And then you can start from a tight binding Hamiltonian for the carbon lattice. And so you have some on-site energy and you also have the hopping terms between the nearest neighbors, say for simplicity. Then there are actually two things that the phonons do. First of all, because you have changing bond lengths, the hopping amplitude between the neighboring carbon sites will change. And this is something that is off-diagonal in the sublattice, because you jump between A and B sublattices. So that actually ends up going into the vector potential and produces the... So this is due to the changes in the bond lengths, and it changes the vector potential. But also, if you have an overall dilation or compression of the lattice, then from the point of view of each carbon electron on a carbon atom, it's sort of caged in if the neighboring atoms move closer. And that gives also a change of the on-site energy of the carbon sites. And that, if you work it through, ends up giving you the scalar potential. So you have, and as you can see, it is actually proportional to the train of this trace, the trace of the strain tensor, which is just giving you the change of area of the lattice. So that's the microscopic way of thinking about the origin of A and phi. And in fact, you can just work it through and get these expressions explicitly if you start from this tight binding Hamiltonian. The other way, which is a bit more general, is based on symmetry. So one thing that is more well known is that if you have time reversal and inversion symmetry, if you use these two for the graphene lattice, then the existence of the Dirac point is protected. At least they can only disappear in pairs or be created in pairs. That's something that you can argue. One way of thinking about this is that if you think about the band structure problem, then the band structure is basically thinking of a system on a torus with magnetic fluxes that thread the torus because of the a to the ik k dot r factors. And so this initially, it seems that these e to the ik r factors basically break time reversal symmetry. They're like a magnetic flux. But actually, it turns out that this band structure problem has a generalized anti-unitary symmetry, which is just a combination of t and time reversal and inversion. So this remains a good anti-unitary symmetry. And as a result, actually, you have a real and symmetric Hamiltonian. And you can always write it as a real and symmetric Hamiltonian. Or in random matrix language, I guess you could say there's an orthogonal symmetry. And then generically, two parameters should be enough to find a level crossing. So all that can happen is that the Dirac point is moving, but the existence of the Dirac point is protected. So if the existence of the Dirac point is protected, then only two things can happen. This long wavelength strain can shift the Dirac point either in energy up and down, and that produces the scalar potential. That's just what just moving the zero of the energy up and down that locally in space. Or it can move the Dirac point in momentum, which is precisely what the vector potential is doing. So that's, I think, based on symmetry, it's also clear that if you have long wavelength dispersion, where you can think in terms of a local lattice, all that can happen is that you can either have a vector potential or a scalar potential. Okay, so that's the origin of these fields. The next question is, now let's get back to the question that I actually want to ask, whether this synthetic electric field associated with a vector potential is actually observable, and maybe a good thing is to check how big the effect is in the first place. So if you want to, we were saying that there is a magnetic field and there's an electric field, and you can compare the two, and what you can compare is the ratio of the forces that are exerted by these two fields. So you have the force associated with the synthetic electric field versus the force associated with the synthetic magnetic field. And so the electric force is E times E. The magnetic force is EVF times B, order of magnitude. And then AE is omega times A. And B is Q times A. I don't care too much about the fact that these are actually vectors. And so the A's go out, the E's go out. If I now assume an acoustic phonon mode with omega proportional to C times Q, then omega over Q is just the phonon velocity. And I get C over VF, which is something of the order of 10 to the minus 2. Certainly, it's much smaller than 1. So at first sight, it seems pretty much hopeless to see the electric field. It's about two orders of magnitude smaller than whatever is associated with the magnetic field. But that's not the end of the story. First of all, there are not only acoustic modes. If omega remained finite as Q goes to zero, then actually everything would be in the electric field. And that's what's happening for the radial breathing mode of the nanotube. Even if you have Q to zero, it still has a finite frequency. And then the electric field is everything. So for the radial breathing mode, omega Q goes to a constant for Q to zero, and then there is only an electric field and no magnetic field associated with it. There is a second thing that you can do. You can simply look at quantities which are unaffected by the magnetic field. And in fact, the most natural quantity that comes to mind in order to check the existence of the electric field is such a quantity. And that is the damping of these phonon modes. And the basic thinking is very simple. If you have these synthetic electric fields, then they will drive some currents in the nanotubes or in the graphene. And if you have currents and electric field, then there is some Joule heating associated with it. And this Joule heating will simply make the phonons decay, damp the phonons. So you get some damping rate for the phonons out of that. And that's something that, since the magnetic field doesn't change the energy, will not be susceptible to the magnetic field in the first place. So this is, OK, so that's the basic idea that we started with, to look at the phonon damping associated with these synthetic electric fields. Now, this is obviously effective for metallic systems. So for graphene, this should be relevant. It should also be relevant for metallic nanotubes. And that's what I will be talking about today. But in actual fact, I think that even for semiconducting nanotubes, this may very well be relevant in many cases, because very often they are self-doped. So there is some finite conductivity, and you will also have damping. But that's something that's very sample specific, and it's so probably what we're saying is relevant, but not it's hard to make any general statements about that. Okay, so that looks very simple, but actually there is one complication. Or one thing that makes life more interesting. And that is that there is not only this synthetic electric field dA dt, but there's also gradient phi. There's also the scalar potential, and that obviously produces an electric field as well. And in fact, if you look at it naively, then the gradient phi is again much larger than this field, and that's simply the bare coupling constant for gradient phi is much larger. Okay, so if you look up in Ando and Suzura, then they estimate that the coupling constant for gradient phi is of order 20 electron volts. That's just the prefactor of this of the trace of the strain tensor. And if you look at the corresponding one for the vector potential, which is Vf h bar beta over 2a, then maybe you find that it's 2 electron volts. So it seems at first sight that this scalar potential is more significant by an order of magnitude. And so why do I talk about the vector potential at all? And so again, there's a but. And the first point is that A dominates for the radial breathing mode, because in the radial breathing mode, you can take Q to zero, and then there's still some finite omega. So A, this electric field remains finite, but this one disappears. Okay. So in the radial breathing mode, in fact, there is only this synthetic electric field, but nothing that is associated with the scalar potential. But actually, it's more interesting than that, and that is that the ADT is unscreened, but the gradient of phi is screened. And that then will significantly change the bare coupling constants, at least in the 2D case, and makes this vector potential, in actual fact, much more important than it would seem based on these bare coupling constants. So why is the electric field associated with the vector potential unscreened? The point is that, again, by time reversal, A and therefore E have opposite signs for the two valleys of the graphene dispersion. The way to think about it is, if you think about back to the magnetic field, if there was only a magnetic field of one sign, it would break time reversal symmetry. But the underlying Hamiltonian clearly preserves time reversal symmetry. It's just a strain that you add. So somehow you have to conserve time reversal symmetry, and the way the system does that is by having opposite magnetic fields for the two valleys, which are just time reversal images of each other. So what you have also for the electric field then is that the electric field has opposite signs in the two valleys, which means that this synthetic electric field associated with A actually drives valley currents, meaning the currents in opposite directions in the two valleys. And that means that you will never induce any charge density, and there is no screening. Okay, so that's one half of the argument. There's actually a second argument that supports that makes it even stronger. So this is one. Two is that you're kind of intuitively drawn to think that all these electric fields have to be longitudinal electric fields. But actually, this is a synthetic electric field. There is no need why it should be longitudinal. And actually, often the ADT is a transverse electric field, meaning it points perpendicular to the wave vector. And then it's not screened in the first place, because again, it doesn't induce any charge densities. So even if it was, well, I guess the reason that this is allowed is only because it's it drives valley currents. So that's why the ADT remains unscreened, but the gradient of phi is, and that will significantly renormalize these coupling constants and make the vector potential comparatively more important. Let me see. Maybe I do it at this point. In particular, what it means is that in 1D, in the nanotube situation, screening is still relatively weak. So for the nanotube, if you have an acoustic mode, actually, it turns out that the scalar potential still dominates. But in 2D, in graphene, if it's doped, then screening is actually quite significant, so in realistic graphene samples. And then you find that actually you overcompensate for this difference, and the vector potential is the more relevant one. So for acoustic, modes, you have that phi relevant in carbon nanotubes and A relevant in graphene. There's actually a second consequence that this valley currents have that I think is maybe the most interesting thing of what comes out of this. And that is that valley currents can decay by electron-electron interactions. Charge currents, unless you have Umklapp, which in graphene doesn't play any role, charge currents are protected by momentum conservation. So electron-electron interactions conserve the momentum and will conserve the current. So they will not contribute to a decay of charge. Electron-electron interactions don't contribute to the decay of charge currents. But valley currents, you can transfer momentum from one valley to the other, reduce the valley current at fixed total momentum, and so valley currents do actually decay by electron-electron interaction, and that's actually something that caused a bit of a stir even here in Santa Barbara a couple of years ago in another context, and that's simply known as spin Coulomb. It's the analog of spin Coulomb drag. So it's valley Coulomb drag that I'm talking about. Spin currents also are not protected by against electron-electron interaction and decay due to electron-electron interactions. And here we simply take the same concept and transfer it to this situation. Okay, so that's sort of the overall picture. Now we just have to become a bit more detailed and look at actually do some calculations. Questions? Or everyone already lost? Okay, so if you want to make this more precise, then you can now, we just want to calculate this damping rate, and you can actually, the simplest thing that you can do is to basically use this thinking, the semi-classical thinking that I was sketching, and you can just look at the time derivative of the elastic energy stored in the phonon mode, and that should be equal to, should be given by the Joule heating, and since we can calculate the electric fields, we can know what the conductivity is, and then we know what the Joule heating is, and we can simply calculate how the phonon mode is decaying. If you want to do it a bit more quantum mechanically, but it leads to exactly the same results, you can also take the phonon self-energy and combine it with Kubo, and then you find that the damping rate of the phonons of some wave vector Q is omega Q divided by 2 E squared H bar omega sigma, the symmetric part of the real and symmetric part of the conductivity tensor as a function of Q and omega. And then you have an electric field A associated with the vector potential, B with the scalar potential. So let me see. And I guess this is component I, and this is component J, and I should close the bracket. And you can see that it is precisely what I'm writing up here, because the change in the energy density is just the phonon decay rate times the energy of the phonon. And if I multiply this by omega, then I have omega squared here, and omega times A is an electric field. So I get just sigma times electric field squared, which is precisely what is written, written up there. Here, the A's are just following from these expressions for A and that I wrote at the beginning of the talk. So, and a similar expression for phi, which I'm not sure is, the details are not so relevant. But basically, this is the prefactor, and then there are some things. P is the polarization of, describes which phonon mode I'm looking at. MQ puts in the relevant Qs, or 1 over R is where R is the radius of the nanotube. So that's just the their simple elasticity theory taken from Landau-Lifschitz. And then you have to take care of the fact, if you talk about nanotubes, then your natural coordinate system is rotated compared, which is with one axis along the nanotube and the other one around the nanotube. That, due to the chirality of the nanotube, that coordinate system is rotated relative to the natural coordinate system of the graphene lattice, and that gives you this rotation matrix by an angle 3 theta because of the threefold symmetry of the graphene lattice. So that's just taking care of some details of carbon nanotubes. Okay. So then what can we get with these sorts of expressions? So let's first the radio breathing mode. Came up several times as sort of the cleanest case in which to see the vector potential. So let's start with that. But I don't want to give any of the details. I just tell you what the results are. So let's assume you have a metallic carbon nanotube. So this is the spectrum. And then the natural decay mechanism is this, where this is the frequency of the radial breathing mode, and it's at q equal to zero. And in fact, of course, this damping has been considered previously in the literature, the simple second order perturbation theory calculation. And what I just want to stress is that this is exactly what we reproduce in this sort of thinking. It's not surprising, but it's good to know. So what you find is due to the chirality of the Dirac carriers, only the azimuthal component of the vector potential actually contributes. And you can calculate the corresponding component of the conductivity tensor. Ah, so I didn't write this here, but sigma, you just express it by using Kubo formulas in the usual way. You calculate sigma yy, and you find some simple expression, which is not. So you have to have a certain if the system is doped, you have a finite KF, then you have have to have a minimal omega in order to dissipate. And all I want to know is that says that this reproduces literature. Exactly. So in some sense, I think this is already answering the question. And that synthetic electric fields have observable consequences because they are simply responsible for the dominant damping mechanism in these radial breathing modes. So despite the fact that they are sometimes small, they have very mundane physics associated. It has very mundane physics associated with it.
So you reproduce the literature.
Can be theory. Let me come to measured data in a second. But this is the extended Dresselhaus family, for example, from which you can get exactly this expression. And I must admit, maybe you can also, you know, anything. Maybe you can. There are measurements of this. I just simply didn't look for measurements. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. So if it was, we stopped here, but that's not the end. So.
So when you have an ordinary metal, so no graphene physics, no different points.
Yeah.
Could you also say call some of the electron photon coupling? Could you call it also synthetic electric fields, or would this just be completely inappropriate language? So I understand here it's very clean because you have this low energy theory.
Yeah.
It's really nothing but electric magnetic fields. So that's very clear, but it's more confusing in the real
form. Of course, in some sense you can. For example, one of the dominant mechanisms for electron phonon coupling in semiconductors is this deformation potential, which is precisely what leads to the phi that I. It's the physics behind the phi that I have in this theory.
I was asking about the A dot. So that's your story is about A dot. So I'm just asking whether the A dot is also something which is always there, or whether it's something special to graphene in some sense.
I thought of it as something special to graphene, but I haven't checked systematically through all the couplings that I would subscribe to that. I bet my life on that statement. Do you have an opinion on that? In graphene, it's a lot more natural, at least, than in the other context.
You can kind of just classify it according to electric magnetic field. Right. Classification is kind of in a complex solid not possible, but.
Right. I would suspect that in general in solids it's a lot more complicated because the lattice structure is going to be much more important and.
But I wouldn't be surprised that there's some part of
that may well be that
coupling
that you could
say it's I could write it like that.
Let's talk about it. I it would be interesting to know. I haven't thought about it, and I don't know it off the top of my head. What's the time?
You have used 35 minutes.
So. 35 minutes. Okay, then I should be quite. Okay. Okay. So. Okay. So this. So far, we've just reformulated simple known things in a. Admittedly, maybe somewhat more complicated, somewhat complicated language. So let's see whether we can get something out of this. So the first thing that you can do is to look at stay with the radial breathing mode and look at the armchair tube. Then actually, this angle theta that I mentioned before is equal to pi over 2, and what comes out of that is that the this damping rate, the literature value is simply zero, and the reason is that the electric field ends up being along the carbon nanotube axis, and then by what I was mentioning earlier, there is no damping associated with it. So in that case, if you have now currents flowing along the nanotube, it's quite natural, at least at some sufficiently high temperature, to add some disorder into the game, and then the make some simple Drude ansatz for the conductivity, and then you can plug this into this expression, and you get some expression for the damping rate, which is whatever it is. I'm not going to write it down. But if you estimate it within ballpark elastic mean free path of the order of, of a micrometer, then you find that the damping rate or the relaxation time that is associated with it becomes of the order of a nanosecond. And that is something that, and to Jan's question, that we can, in fact, compare with experiment, because there's an experiment by the Decker group of a few years ago in Nature, and they find relaxation times for the radial breathing mode that are exactly of this order. So these mechanisms do seem to be relevant and of the experimentally observed order of magnitude. Okay, so that was the radial breathing mode. What I want to do now is to discuss, the remaining time, is to discuss acoustic modes, both in carbon nanotubes and in graphene, and there are surprisingly many differences between the two cases. So first of all, for the acoustic modes, there is no damping based on simple particle hole excitation. So in the clean case, you would come out with zero damping, simply because the phonon dispersion, it has omega equal to CQ, and the electronic dispersion has omega equal to VFQ. The velocities differ by two orders of magnitude, so there's no way of conserving energy and momentum. So you have no damping in the case of clean carbon nanotubes. The second thing is that, as I was mentioning before, phi dominates because of this much larger Baer coupling, and the screening in 1D doesn't make up for this large difference. The electric field then is proportional, it's parallel to the Q vector, so it's a longitudinal field, and parallel to the axis of the carbon nanotube. And so then what we do is to simply assume some, make an ansatz for the diffusive conductivity at finite Q and omega, and which is this. And then you, if you do that, then you find the following. First of all, remember that omega for the phonon mode is also c times q. So at small q, clearly omega is going to dominate, whereas at larger q, there will be a crossover to where the dq squared is going to dominate. And this crossover occurs actually at rather small q's, q naught, which is equal to c over vf times 1 over the elastic mean free path. So at wavelengths of the order of 100 times the elastic mean free path. And as a function of q, then you find two different regimes how the damping depends on q, because in one case it's the conductivity just, if omega dominates, it's just sigma dc, whereas if dq squared dominates, then it's going to be 1 over q squared, the real part of this. So as a result, as a function of q, schematically a behavior like that, where up to q naught you get a quadratic dependence on q, and beyond that it saturates to become constant. So now the question is whether what you really want to know is whether the mode is underdamped, overdamped, whatever, and how strong is the damping. So in the if it was overdamped, you would need a mode frequency that behaves somewhat like this. If it's underdamped, it would be like that. And in fact, what the maximum damping relative to the mode frequency that you can get happens at this wave vector q naught. And actually, if you put in numbers, then this is rather significant. It's of something of the order of 1 over 10. So it is still underdamped, but it's quite significantly damped for certain q's. But it's rather long q's. And then as you go to larger q's, it becomes relatively less important.
Statement no damping in clean case, is this also valid when you have interactions, intervalley interactions? You mentioned
that. Yeah, right. As long as you think about the scalar potential, it's true, because the scalar potential drives charge currents. Okay, but of course there is a subdominant process due to the vector potential.
We're talking about phi.
And that would produce some damping. So there is at a much smaller magnitude, there is some damping even in the clean case due to this Valley-Coulomb drag mechanism. But it's strongly suppressed compared to this this case. Okay. And in fact, actually, this ratio is surprisingly universal. It's independent of the elastic mean free path. It just drops out. So what changes as a function of elastic mean free path is for which q you get this strong damping. But it's otherwise completely independent of the maximal ratio is independent of q. Okay, so then graphene. So naively, let's start again with no damping in clean case in leading order. The Valley-Coulomb drag comes later. Now it's going to be A that dominates. So nominally, the effect is a lot weaker. But we will see that there are two reasons for why it actually is not a lot weaker. The next thing is that the damping becomes anisotropic, depending in which direction your phonon modes are running, since this A is a vector, and the nature of the electric field changes. So if you restrict yourself, just to keep things simple, to q parallel to either the x direction or the y direction of the graphene ladder, so basically either in the armchair direction, which is x, or in the zigzag direction, which would be y, then you can kind of make a table that propagation in x and y, and longitudinal phonon and transverse phonon. So what you find is that here you have a transverse electric field. Here you have a parallel electric field, longitudinal electric field. And let's see, here it's again longitudinal electric field, and here it's a transverse electric field. So depending on which kind of phonon you have and in which direction they travel, sometimes you have a transverse and sometimes you have a longitudinal electric field. And that has, again, important consequences. So let's first look at the case of a longitudinal electric field. So we are either in this situation or in that situation. Then it's very much like the nanotube case, because we have this diffusive conductivity with a longitudinal electric field. So at first sight, you're tempted to just write down exactly the same conductivity, but actually it's not everything, because in this case, we are driving valley currents, and there's no conservation law for valley charge. And as a result, this diffusion pole is not protected. And if you have intervalley disorder scattering, then it will cut off this diffusion pole. And so you should actually be using this expression. And despite the fact that this intervalley scattering in graphene is rather weak, it can have very significant effects. So what you get, if you work it through, is actually you get the same figure as in the nanotube case, but now this is the maximum of Q and a length scale that is associated with the intervalley disorder scattering, where LV is just d times, square root d times tau v. D is the diffusion coefficient. So what you, if 1 over LV is larger than Q naught, then this Q squared increase continues for a lot longer than in the nanotube case. And that actually leads to an enhancement of this damping. And this enhancement can be very significant. So despite the fact that 1 over tau V is small compared to the intra-valley scattering, it significantly enhances damping. By, let's say, up to 10 to the 4, which is just Vf over C squared. So to begin with, because you're talking about a vector potential, the effect is of roughly two orders of, three or four orders of magnitude smaller compared to the nanotube. A lot of it can be made up by the fact that intervalley scattering enhances it. I don't really have a good feeling for why that is, but actually there's a nice relation to some old work on that I heard about, I didn't read it yet, on acoustic attenuation in silicon, where you also have valleys. And people have been, in the old Russian times, have been finding exactly the same sort of enhancement that we are finding here. Okay, so if you want to get an idea of what's the strength of this, then if you actually put numbers in, it's 10 to the minus, the maximal ratio of gamma over omega is 10 to the minus 6 by the times the enhancement factor. So about a 1% quality factor of 100, roughly, is the minimal quality factor that one finds. Okay. So a few more minutes. So now this was the longitudinal electric field for the transverse electric field actually sigma q and omega. If you solve some simple equations, it's just the DC conductivity, basically, because there's no charge buildup due to transverse electric fields. And then actually what you, the picture looks like this. Here's 1 over L. Up to there, we can take this theory only in any case. And then you, this Q squared increase extends all the way to 1 over L. So the effect is a lot stronger. You don't cut this Q squared increase off at some smaller Q. So basically, you get this enhancement factor of 10 to the 4 every single time. And then you can continue, actually, if you use that in the which way does it go? Okay, yes. In the ballistic regime, this is for Q in the diffusive regime. And if you take, work out what happens with, for transverse electric fields in the ballistic regimes when Q is much larger than 1 over L, then you find that it goes like 1 over Q. And so it just continues linearly beyond that. The slopes, I don't know how, what they do. So gamma of Q is quadratic for Q less than 1 over L and linear for Q larger than 1 over L. So again, it's, it behaves in the same way as the mode frequency itself. And you may want to know what gamma Q over omega Q is. And if we do our estimates right, it's equal to 10 to the minus 2, which is actually, so these modes are relatively significantly damped by this mechanism. Okay. Finally, I was saying that electron-electron interactions do something, and that's simply included in all of this. Basically, what we have to do is that we have to evaluate the DC conductivity and the diffusion coefficient with not only including the intralayer scattering, the intervalley, intravalley scattering, intervalley scattering, but also we need to have this electron-electron scattering between the valleys. So the simplest estimate, which is that just the ordinary Fermi-liquid scattering rate, which agrees with all the drag literature. So this is up to numbers. This is also, and possibly a log. This is the correct form. And if you now estimate where this drag becomes important, so it becomes important for T larger than T star, which is something of the order of tens of Kelvin. So actually, for rather low temperatures, this Coulomb valley drag mechanism becomes the dominant scattering. And the interesting consequence of that is that even in the clean case, if you now ignore this order altogether, then you have somewhere a temperature where you go from the for fixed Q, you have some temperature where you go from the ballistic to the diffusive regime. So this is T1, which is, let's see, EF times square root of Q over KF. And actually, the surprising thing possibly is that if you plot gamma Q as a function of temperature, then the higher the temperature, the weaker the damping is becoming. And that is simply because the damping is proportional to sigma, which is proportional to the elastic mean free path, not to 1 over the elastic mean free path. It's proportional to 1 over the scattering rate. Yeah. So that's for the transverse electric field case. And there's a similar curve for the longitudinal electric field, which looks something There's another. Then it's actually non-monotonous. It increases at low temperatures and then goes back down at higher temperatures without disorder. Okay, so that's basically the end of the stories of the story. I was discussing whether these synthetic electric fields in graphene have any physical consequences, and what we find is that they actually dominate the damping of phonon modes, and they bring, if you think about it in this way, then you can get some order into the damping of all of these of all the various phonon modes in carbon nanotubes and in graphene. In fact, there's a recent paper which looks at nonlinear elastic effects, phonon-phonon interactions for damping in carbon nanotubes, and I think that these types of damping mechanisms will ultimately be much more important. Their motivation, of course, was that in the clean case, in the lowest order theory, you don't get any damping from this electron-phonon interactions. I think that the story is, can be quite relevant for using carbon nanotubes and graphene as nano-electromechanical systems, where people are very interested in having systems with long phonon relaxation times. And there's various things that have been predicted that happen in this limit. And one direction that one could take this in the future is that one could think in the nanotube case a bit more carefully what happens if you actually take the electronic correlations in the nanotube into account, which we've ignored entirely in this story. Thanks.
Do you have any comments on what will happen in bilayer?
I think much of the story just goes through in bilayer. I mean, look, remember that we were thinking about the doped case all along, and in that case, I think and the phonon modes are long wavelength, so they do the same thing to the two layers. So I think it's just modulo factors of two and pi. It's going to be the same the story.
What about dumping induced by two phonon absorptions? Did you estimate in the background two phonon absorption, which avoids all the kinematic restrictions, not on the low?
So high order perturbation theory.
Second order.
Yeah. No, we have not estimated. Maybe it's a good point. We should do that. But these effects are strong, so I don't expect that.
Open the whole phase space of all the phonons.
But the coupling constants are small to small. So there is one more case that we didn't discuss and that we don't know the answer yet, which is somewhat similar. That if you have flexural modes of the graphene, then the coupling is actually quadratic, mm-hmm. And in some sense you have this even in lowest order, and we just don't know what the answer is in that case.
Questions?
So is this relevant for heat conduction experiments in carbon nanotubes in any way, or is it?
Good point. Probably. We haven't thought about it. Do you have any comments on this? It's another direction that one could think of.
Hmm? Oh, the question is whether this is relevant for heat conduction. So,
I mean,
there's the danger that it's dominated by the small cube, that therefore it drops out.
Well, and by the electrons, right? The electrons will probably give their dominant contribution. So the phonons, I think, are probably, since we're always talking about the metallic case, we also cannot turn the electrons off in this story.
I was thinking when you really have a Dirac point.
Right, but straight at the Dirac point, I mean, you see, this was all for quote-unquote real graphene, some distance away from the Dirac point. It's actually something else that one may want to think about, what happens closer to the Dirac point.
Okay. Further questions?
Well, if not, let's thank Flexer again.